A subpoena doesn't just demand documents. It sends a message, especially when it's from the Department of Justice. It drains resources and intimidates institutions, let alone individual physicians. This is how the DOJ is being weaponized against gender-affirming care and one physician's story of standing up for their patients. Dr. Crystal Beal, a board-certified family medicine physician, started QueerDoc. They provide high-quality, expert, and individualized queer and gender-affirming medical care through QueerDoc. They have lived experience as a non-binary femme and are super queer themselves, enjoying queer burlesque, vintage fashion, and their queer, kinky, poly family. Dr. Beal attended Florida State University College of Medicine in Tallahassee, Florida. While there, they helped found the LGBTQ medical student group. After leaving after medical school, they completed their training at Valley Family Medicine Residency Program in Washington State. Continuing to see gaps in care for the LGBTQ plus community, Dr. Beal sought extensive additional training in sexual health, queer health, and gender-affirming care. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, the show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs. I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. Dr. Crystal Beal, welcome back to the podcast. And Adrian Levitt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Bradley.
So let's get to the heart of it, because you recently had an interaction with the Department of Justice, right? Which is something that, as we're going through medical school, residency, something that none of us ever thinks is going to happen. And it recently happened to you. So what happened?
Yeah, that's actually how Adrian and I met. Adrian's an attorney with the ACLU in Washington. And so in June of 2025, the practice I founded and started and own was subpoenaed by the Department of Justice. They announced that they sent out over 20 subpoenas in this process, and a handful of them are public now, including ours. And the subpoenas were like basically identical. If you read them, they seem like rather copy and pasted. And what makes that particularly interesting, like as a physician and practice owner, right, is like I own a small private practice, and all of the other subpoenas we're aware of at this point went to Boston Children's Hospital and Seattle Children's Hospital and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And so it's just a very different experience to get one of those in a small private practice versus a large academic institution.
These are large academic institutions that have in-house counsel, and they have the funds to get outside counsel, and you know, they have deep pockets, and you are alone.
Yeah, and thin, so I don't even get pockets in my clothes. Like, they don't give me pockets.
I am glad you're keeping your sense of humor about this.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've been really fortunate to be able to have counsel with Washington ACLU and with Arnold and Porter and Perkins and Coues, which are all phenomenal law firms and attorneys. And I had been engaged with counsel prior to this happening because what has been happening in the field of gender-affirming care. And so I am able to access that legal representation pro bono, which is the only way that I've been able to like continue forward in this process.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of their goals was likely to just strong-arm you into just having to close your doors.
Right? Absolutely. Yes. And I asked when I first engaged with Arnold and Porter years ago about like how much they regularly charge. It's like, Bradley, it's like they charge $1,800 an hour. And I don't even know how many attorneys working on this at this point. Like I've met like 15, but I'm like, oh my God, that is so many dollars.
Well, let's go through this in chronological order. So first of all, just so our audience knows, like what exactly it is we're talking about. I think it's the case law, and Adrian, you're the expert here in this, is United States versus Scrimeti, right?
I am a semi-expert, at least a lawyer. It makes me something. Yeah. Scrimeti plays a big part in this case, but it's Scrimeti is, of course, the recent Supreme Court case regarding gender-affirming care bans and upholding that and equal protection analysis to trans people. And that plays a part of it. And certainly, I think, kicked off a lot of the government's work to do what it's announced that it wants to do, which is and the provision of gender-affirming care for adolescents. And the subpoenas are an interesting part of that because they are part and parcel to the government's stated goal, but a separate kind of legal tool that the government's trying to use. And so these subpoenas come out of a different part of government power about civil investigative power, and in this case, purportedly through the FDA. So it is both related and separate, but certainly part of the goal to end the provision of care for adolescents.
And so that case, I think it was in Tennessee originally, where they passed a law that outlawed gender-affirming care for minors. And I think the individuals that were affected by that then sued the state, please correct me if I'm wrong here, saying that it was discrimination. And then it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that it wasn't discrimination because it's for minors. So because it affects minors, then it's therefore not discrimination. And we're not going to get into a legal argument here, right? We're not here to relitigate that. But they found an argument for being legalizing discrimination, right, against what should be a protected class.
Yes. And I would love to relitigate that case here with you anytime. So invite me back. Thank you so much. But that's right. They got their way to sort of an excuse to say that this type of discrimination is permitted under the Constitution. And how they got there was a significant feat indeed.
Yeah. And so that's out there. And so, Dr. Beal, is that when you said, I need to start lawyering up? I need to start contacting the ACLU? And
oh, no, that was quite a long time before that, actually, because state bans started happening in 2021.
Okay.
So I had started seeking like legal advice and support when state bans started happening. And so I had not met Adrian or talked to the ACLU back then. We met with this subpoena in June. But I had worked with other, like the Abortion Defense Network is a organization that has a lot of legal counsel for providers doing reproductive health care. And so they started offering some support for gender-affirming care providers back when state bans started happening. And so that was how I was originally connected with counsel. Yeah. And then I think the context of this, like what has happened, right? There's the bigger picture, like what you're referencing with Scrimeti, and then there is all these other ways that the administration has attempted to end gender-affirming care with like executive orders and with CMS funding, the Department of Health and Human Services report that was not written by healthcare experts at all.
No, like, if they did, they're going to find out that they're wrong and they don't want to hear that they're wrong. There's a bunch of themes in this administration, which is not counseling the experts, taking counsel from people who think that they're experts and then cite misinformation to back that up. And they're among a number of other themes. Cruelty, et cetera. Okay, so you have decided since 2021, because of the stance that this administration previously and currently have taken against gender-affirming care, that this is something that you need to get ahead of. And then what happened with the Department of Justice contacting you? Like, how did you get that subpoena?
Yeah, so on file with the state of Washington is my business representative, and that's actually my accountant. So it got served to me through my accountant, actually. It was like very anticlimactic. Brad, I've seen so many TV shows and movies where someone's like, you've been served, and they hand you the paper. And I like thought I would have my cute heels in my purse. And, you know, it was just an email.
And you think maybe it was a dance off, right? You've been served. And then you'd have to go through your dance moves, and then they'd go through their dance moves, and it would be a dance.
It would be finally my debut as a break dancer, which I have been waiting for 42 years. But
an email to your accountant.
From my accountant.
That was copy pasted from the other emails that they sent to these pediatric institutions, which, to your point earlier, they've gone after through cutting CMS fundings. So all of these pediatric gender-affirming care institutions have had their funding cut from Medicare and Medicaid, and they've had to shut their doors because otherwise the hospital would need to shut down. Like, this is how this administration is getting their way. Yeah. And so then you get the email through your accountant, and then what happens next?
Yeah. And so I engaged multiple counsels to see like who was the right fit for us and for the case, and ended up with the counsel that we have, and then really went through the process of knowing that it feels like bullying, right?
But again, another theme of this administration is bullying the vulnerable, right?
Yeah. So I think my legal strategy was really rooted in both what I think my ethical obligation as a physician is in the context of providing like evidence-based medically necessary healthcare. I've been subpoenaed because I've been doing the job I trained to do my entire life. And so I think like my ethical obligation is to continue that care. The research and literature says that it is life-saving, you know? And I think sometimes clinicians get caught up on that do no harm. And they're like, well, if I'm not providing care, is not actively doing harm. But I think another part of the Hippocratic Oath is actually that do no harm also involves not restricting people from the access to the goods of life. It's an old language, weird words, but I think that's just so important to remember that this is life-saving healthcare. And if we were talking about diabetes or if we were talking about breast cancer, more clinicians would be outraged about what is happening.
Yeah. You know, we hang our hat on that do no harm and like it's the word of God. And basically it was the word of some Greek guy thousands of years ago. And we're like, this is still our North Star. But to your point, it's do the right thing, right? Like I have to follow my moral compass and do the right thing, but you're doing it while putting yourself at significant risk.
Yeah. And so I think that's the thing, right? So I kind of had my understanding of my own ethical obligation and my values, and the legal team was like incredibly supportive of finding a way forward with that. And so we moved to quash, fancy new words I learned. The subpoena on its face, also a fancy turn of legal frame, and which actually several other institutions did as well. So Boston Children's did that as well. Seattle Children's did that as well. And we've actually seen all of those cases succeed in the district court, which I think really supports how much of a bullying expedition this is, right? Like, I'm not the legal expert, but if there was some validity in these subpoenas, like, probably some district court judge would have been like, maybe we need to negotiate. Maybe we don't just need to say, yeah, actually, y'all are right. This is bullying. And so it's been actually really affirming, I think, to see as like more of the decisions came out. Yeah, that's been lovely. And so in the district court, the judge agreed with us and quashed the subpoena. We didn't have to surrender any records to the Department of Justice. And then the Department of Justice appealed to the circuit court. So we're governed by the Ninth Circuit. And they actually expedited our appeal in front of everyone else's. So yeah, the tiny, small private practice, our appeal will be heard first in the nation, which I think has a tendency to possibly set precedent for the other appeals. I think Boston's is in the First Circuit and Colorado's is in the Fourth. Thinking about going back to law school, just because at this point, I like have learned so much.
That seems, it's daunting. Like this is a big responsibility for you.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
It doesn't feel like there's an alternative.
Yeah.
Like, I think sometimes people, yeah, are like, oh, how are you doing this? Or how is this possible? And I'm like, how are you not? We are talking about a generation of trans adolescents, like hundreds of whom will not make it into adulthood because this happened. And we have the thing they need.
And so the Department of Justice, because I want to get into that a little more, which is in sending you the subpoena, they then subpoenaed protected health information, right? And on what grounds are they subpoenaing? And can you discuss what that was about? So we do know it's about providing gender-affirming care to adolescents.
So the whole subpoena is public record. So absolutely, we can say what was subpoenaed. So they subpoenaed like any training materials that I have. They subpoenaed any interactions or conversations I've had with any pharmaceutical manufacturers or drug reps. They subpoenaed all my documentation about billing, which is really fascinating because I don't bill health insurance. We're a fee-for-service practice. And then they also subpoenaed medical records for starting from January 1st, 2020, for every patient I prescribed puberty blockers or hormones for. And because I'm also family medicine and see all ages, that is all of my patients, not just my adolescent patients. And in those patient records, they wanted names, addresses, dates of birth, and social security numbers, which was quite concerning.
Yeah. And this was done through the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, right? Like that's the lever that they're pulling.
Yeah. And like they're kind of using this piece of law that like hasn't historically been used to come after individual clinicians, but has been used for pharmaceutical manufacturers and like meth.
Manufacturers and marketing, right? For if they're going to be making claims that they can't back up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're after like fraud. They said patient educational material that's on our website counted as drug labeling.
Okay. And so can you divulge anything else about what it is? What are they claiming?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, their claims have been rejected by the district court. So the district court found that their purported reasons for investigating providers, including Dr. Beal and QueerDoc, as well as the hospitals, was an improper purpose. It was basically that their purported reasons for the investigation weren't real. And part of that record came from all of the statements the federal government has made about ending the provision of care. The federal government has said a lot. And when you say a lot and then, you know, use a law that is not for that reason, it draws questions. Then that's what the Western District said. But what they purported to be investigating was violations of the FDCA regarding drug manufacturing, which doesn't make much sense because Krystal does not manufacture drugs, labeling, and doctors can't label drugs either, or billing, and QueerDoc does not bill. And so these were kind of the general statements of investigation, and it was noteworthy in something that Krystal said before, which is these subpoenas were overwhelmingly identical between all of the various subpoena recipients. And so that shows that goes even further to improper purpose. And they have shifted throughout the litigation what their claim has been, what they're actually seeking to investigate. That's changed as I think they've run into some roadblocks about how does the FDCA apply to a provider rather than a manufacturer.
So is there any precedent for the FDCA being used, or this is the first incident that you're aware of where it's been used to go after a provider?
That's right. And it's a novel theory. It's the first time they've tried to do this, and the court has rejected it. The court said that's not the power that you have through this administrative investigative subpoena. Does not give you the power under the FDCA to go and investigate a provider for the reasons that you're saying that you want to.
Okay. And so they sent you this subpoena that didn't make any sense with regarding the care. But in doing so, they were also sequestering these health records of a vulnerable population, right? And so this is very concerning, right? And so even if, you know, you were found to be taking excellent care, inappropriate care, and they now still have access to this information for individuals to go on their lists, right?
Well, and I'll just put a legal point on one thing is that serving a subpoena, as soon as there's a legal process to quash, which is just a fancy way to say cancel to make lawyers feel good about ourselves. So when we move to quash the subpoena, at that point, there's no obligation to produce records. And so the receipt of a subpoena, if there's legal process after, doesn't create the obligation. So at this point, there's been no disclosure of records from QueerDoc whatsoever. And the district court agreed with that. The district court said the subpoena is quashed, it's canceled. You need not produce records because this was an unlawful government subpoena.
But it sounds like you're saying they're going to try to find other ways. They're going to rephrase their copy-pasted subpoenas and try and just keep trying until they're successful or have, because their funds are limitless. They're coming from us. And so do you think that's the goal?
Well, they've told us what the goal is. I mean, that's one advantage is that they've been transparent. The goal is to end the provision of care for adolescents. And they're shifting their reasons to try to please a court, to try to have a court say, you know what, actually, this was a lawfully issued subpoena, either in full or in part. I mean, that's the process they're going through right now. And then we've seen them change tactics throughout the last year, whether it's going to be these administrative subpoenas issued to many providers, at least 20, whether it's going to be through the provision of funding, whether it's going to be through executive orders, whether it's going to be through administrative actions. And so I think they change their tactics depending on what the roadblocks that they reach. And of course, it sort of potentially is an obvious point, but to target a small community-based provider, you know, I think some of that goal, whether or not, regardless of the sort of the legal process around the subpoena, is to end care through just the threat. And that's a very real part, I think, of what's going on.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the podcasts over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Telemedicine Talks. Telemedicine is revolutionizing healthcare. Dr. Lee Damasco and Phoebe Gutierrez, Telemedicine Talks, bring you to the forefront of this digital transformation, featuring insights from pioneers and practitioners. Stay ahead of the curve. Subscribe to Telemedicine Talks and navigate the future of medicine with confidence. Right. It's got to be terrifying to get something like this from a government agency and you don't know what to do next. You already have, Dr. Bill, those connections because you've been utilizing or you've been in touch with these different legal counsels since 2021. but maybe someone who hasn't been, now they get this letter and it's got to be terrifying. And so they're in goal of intimidation. Are you familiar with anyone in whom the intimidation was successful? I mean, you know, notwithstanding what we said earlier about cutting funding from CMS.
Well, I think I was reading recently that like maybe over 40 institutions that have stopped providing adolescent gender affirming care in the past year. Children's Hospital Los Angeles, one of the largest providers of adolescent gender affirming care, one of the oldest clinics in the country for adolescent gender affirming care, quit providing care. They closed their doors. So I think, yeah, there's been a lot of.
So it sounds like they're pulling all the levers and they're just trying to figure out which ones work, right? And if they encounter enough roadblocks with the subpoenas, they're just going to try to find another way.
That seems like a correct assessment.
Okay. This is terrifying. And so the sequestering of personal health records, then, you know, whether they do it through this subpoena or another one, they would then have access to these records for a vulnerable population. Do you foresee other practices having similar experiences? Like, who else should be chilled to the bone by this? I mean, all of us, clearly, because we should be looking out for people, right? That's what we signed up for, whether we're looking out for their sinuses or whatever, right? We want the best for our patients and our population. And so, but which specialties do you think they might end up coming for next?
Oh, I don't know if I have that crystal ball, despite my fabulous name, but I do think we've already seen them attempt similar tactics with reproductive rights and reproductive health care. Like, we've already seen them decimate public health in the context of just like taking down important information and education around infectious diseases. And then we're watching like ICE interfere with healthcare in an extreme way. And as scary as I think this subpoena process has been, I can't imagine being a clinician with masked and armed officers trying to interfere with my care. So I think for me, the thing that I have experienced through this subpoena process is that every attorney I've talked to along the way has been kind of shocked and appalled about the breadth of this subpoena and about this tactic. And then if they are successful with this, which thank goodness the judges have agreed with us that they haven't been so far, is that they could then use similar tactics to target any kind of healthcare that is just unagreeable to them, whether that's, you know, reproductive healthcare, whether that's mental health care, whether that's healthcare for people who are disabled or neurodiverse. I think it's quite concerning.
So by the time this episode airs, the next phase of your story will have happened, right? For the listeners, what comes next for you?
We have oral arguments at the Circuit Court. So my fabulous attorneys will talk to the judge there. And then from my understanding, it's a panel of judges. There's three of them. And it can take them usually anywhere from 1 month to 1 year to decide the outcome. So next steps, oral arguments. And then next step is hurry up and wait.
So if there's one thing you would want other physicians to know about this that we haven't discussed yet, or that you want them to know, and then the next question is going to be want them to do. So I'd ask that of each of you. What is something that you want our physician listeners to know about this?
Well, there's a lot of things I would want physician listeners to know. I guess the thing I would say is that there's a really significant legal support in this process. And it's just critical to be in touch. And they can be in touch with ACLU. They can be in touch, as Crystal said, with the Abortion Defense Network. And there are tactics and really smart lawyers thinking about this throughout across the country. And for example, the receipt of this subpoena didn't mean the production of records at this point. And so we are here to support. We believe in the provision of care for trans adolescents and adults very deeply. And so I think that this has been an effort of working together to understand the medical needs, borrow so much medical expertise and use legal expertise to go to court and to stand up against the federal government and to make sure that they're not succeeding and to make sure that we're protecting patients and adolescents as well and parents who are really scared. So I would say just be sure to call a lawyer.
Yeah, I feel like, oh, Paul is going to lose it after this one. But I think in my experience over the past like handful of years, as this started progressing the way it's gone, I've done more learning and research about physicians in pre-war Germany And the data seems to suggest that over half of the physicians that existed in Nazi Germany joined the Nazi Party. And I think, you know, there was a really different response. Like, don't get me wrong. The Netherlands did some shitty stuff with giving the Nazis just people's addresses and locations, right? But Dutch physicians actually declined to join the Nazi Party. They refused to participate in the medical practices of a regime that, like, used medicine to experiment, torture, and kill people. And I know it can sound extremist, and I think that's, like, when I was in elementary school reading Anne Frank, I remember wondering what I would do if I was in that kind of situation. Would I have helped people or would I have not helped people? And I just, like, didn't know. And then I remember being in medical school and learning about the HIV and AIDS epidemic and really wondering, like, would I have provided care for these people or would I have not? And I just never could answer those questions for myself. And I feel like in some ways this has given me an opportunity to answer those questions for myself. And I think it is really scary. And when our own personal welfare and safety and security and home and shelter is threatened, that becomes really scary. And, like, this is not an individual fight. I am not alone in this. And if I only focus on those things, I lose sight of my values and where I think justice lies.
Yeah, I think they are the villains, right? And they have to find a way to sleep at night thinking that they're the hero. And so they bend the truth in such a way that they somehow can sleep at night thinking that they're the heroes and they're sacrificing and risking nothing. And you are clearly risking so much to be the hero here. And so not only are you proving that you are the hero in this situation, but you're leading the charge. And thank you for doing that. Thank you for being the role model that these kids need, that they can look to and see that there's someone out there that supports them and that's willing to fight for them. And so what else can we do, right? So clearly donate to the ACLU, vote in the midterms, go to protests.
I think clinicians, like, gender affirming care is not rocket science. Like, in the technical realms of what we do as physicians and the things we have trained, it's really quite unchallenging. And so it is something that is well within the scope of practice of thousands of clinicians, even clinicians who think it's not in their scope. It actually is. And so learn how to do this care and provide this care. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a point where I can't do it anymore. I won. Tiny human with a very cute little dog. And so I think that's, like, one of the most important and essential things people can do. And then talk to people. This is not exactly how progress works, but right when we passed marriage equality, like, over 80% of Americans said that they knew someone who is gay, lesbian, or bisexual. Right now, like, a third or less of Americans report knowing someone who is transgender. And so I think as physicians, we have such respected roles in community and in society. And so I think a really important part of our job in showing up and doing this, like, advocacy work is just, like, that misinformation campaign is so powerful. So really being part of combating that misinformation campaign. So learn how to do this work and talk to your friends. Your friends don't hang out with me. Like, they don't want to hang out with some weird queer, you know, but they should.
I've been fortunate enough to have a few of these interviews with you.
But, right, y'all have access to rooms I would never get into. And so it's just so important to talk about this because we're real people. And all we want is to be people. Like, we don't actually have an agenda except for staying alive.
Yeah.
You know,
leave me alone. Let me do my thing. Leave me alone. Yeah. Leave me alone. Get out of my business. Yeah. You know, they talk. The other side talks so much about getting the government out of your business. And yet they're doing the best that they can to get the government in your business. So donate to the ACLU, vote in the midterms, go to protests, talk to people, learn about gender affirming care. And if it's in your scope of practice, learn about it. And as Dr. Beal's saying, it's not that complicated. However, from legal counsel, what would you like to add?
It's hard to add anything to that. I think Dr. Beal summed it up. The only thing I could add is that we're all in this struggle together and it's bigger than just gender affirming care. It's bigger than trans people. And so we see this work as totally connected with other struggles for freedom and autonomy. And so I would just urge us all to keep that in mind as we move forward.
Yeah. Wait, okay. I do have one more plug. I think a place that connects the issues with ICE and healthcare and the issues with reproductive rights and mandatory reporting and trans care is the Beyond Do No Harm Network. So any clinicians who are listening and have not had a training by the Beyond Do No Harm Network, please reach out to them. They will be happy to do a training with your institution or organization, or at least historically. I'm not quite sure what they're doing right these days, but and they have a lot of training materials up on their website, and they're just a phenomenal organization.
What is the Beyond Do No Harm Network?
Yeah, they are an organization that is really about taking criminalization out of healthcare and having equitable access to healthcare. And so a lot of their work does center around like clinicians really understanding what is actually required with mandatory reporting, right? Because mandatory reporting, clinicians, similar to these subpoenas, kind of how you were suggesting, Bradley, you get a subpoena and you're just scared and you don't know what to do. You know, mandatory reporting stuff comes up and we're like, not totally sure. And we're like, I have to tell people. And we don't always fully understand actually what we have to tell people, when we have to tell them and who we have to tell them. And the way that plays out, right, is that because we are a biased and discriminatory society, mandatory reporting, you know, disproportionately harms Black and Brown families. And we see Black and Brown families torn apart. And so for issues that white families just don't have to deal with. And so that's like where their work stems from. But they do a lot of training and education about what you have to do with mandatory reporting, what's required in documentation and what isn't. Like, because we're trained, right, to document for insurance purposes, legal protective purposes, and to communicate with other clinicians in the chart. And then the 72 other things that Epic actually wants us to do as well. And so they bring us back to like, what are the actual requirements in this documentation? And how can I make this documentation safer for the people I'm taking care of? Which I think, as Adrian was saying, this is all a united issue. The potential for progression of this administration, like keeping our patients safe. Because if our patients don't feel like they can tell us information without it being in front of the federal government, like it ruins the therapeutic relationship. So I think Beyond Do No Harm is a phenomenal resource for people to check out.
You know, what Adrian said earlier about you never know who they're going to come after next. And Dr. Beal, you had mentioned the precedent with physicians in Nazi Germany, right? I don't remember the poem that came out of it, but like, first they came for, right? Mm-hmm. And so first they came for undocumented immigrants, and then they came for trans kids, and then they came for me. And so the time to act was 10 years ago, right? That was the best time to act. And the second best time to act is now. And so if not for the interest of the most vulnerable, who I think the way that you judge a society is the way that they treat their most vulnerable, right? And so if not for the most vulnerable, then for the fact that they may be coming for you or someone you love next, because you never know who they are coming for. You never know who's going to be on those lists, and if history repeats itself. So I just want to thank you so much for being the hero of so many stories. Now, you're putting yourself out there. And you are doing that. You are protecting the most vulnerable. And so thank you. The work that you do is so admirable. And it's not likely as easy as you're claiming it to be, but we don't want to make it seem more complicated for those. But just to plug that, if I remember correctly, you do teach gender-affirming care as well. So if the listeners are looking to learn, and this is not why you reached out to me, right? You weren't looking to plug it. This was totally my idea, but might as well take this opportunity and help people learn gender-affirming care. So if they want to learn,
absolutely,
how do they do it?
Yeah. The shameless self-promotion plug.
Queer, it wouldn't be a podcast without it.
Yeah. Queer See Me, QUEERCME.com. I do actually have an annual subscription service where you can get over 40 hours of continuing education, all in gender-affirming care and transgender medicine. I also have a podcast that you can get free CE for listening to. So yeah, check me out over there.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time, for all the work that you do, taking care of the patients that you do. And because this precedent is so dangerous, thank you for what you're doing for all of us.
Thank you for having me back on, Brad.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review, take a screenshot, and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or legal advice or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.